يوسف جلالي بتهران
روباشافت غازا
جروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
راشا ساقلم اسطنبول
سعيد امين عالمي كابول
شهان بات اندين ادمنستيرد كشمير
Around the world with reporters.
Lebanon has marked the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from Israeli occupation. On this year's anniversary, Beirut was seen to a conference on the resistance front's fight against the world arrogance. The meeting, held by the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance, was attended by guests from over 60 countries. The four-day congregation's theme is the resilience of the axis of resistance and its role in breaking the siege, ending sanctions, and overthrowing normalization.
This is more than necessary now to unite the people against this American-Israel aggression because we have the same problem everywhere. You know this very good from the Middle East. I am from Serbia. We know it as well from the Balkans. But now they start to attack the other European countries because they only use terrorism, like they kill General Soleimani.
Some participants said the liberation of southern Lebanon in 2000 and other victories for the resistance front in the last few decades are catalysts for a shift to a multipolar world.
Definitely, there's been a huge change in the world. First, because of the strength of the resistance in our region and the defeat of the American troops in Iraq, Afghanistan, in Lebanon, in Syria. This is now infecting the whole world in hope to escape American hegemony. So we see even this shift of multipolarity actually started because of the resistance in our region.
Western guests present at the conference believe there is growing awareness on the need for resistance against arrogant powers.
The awareness itself is shaped by resistance. So the actual victories in Palestine, in Syria, in Cuba, in Venezuela, these are the things that really shape people's consciousness. But we in the gathering here want to reinforce the values that people have a proper understanding of the importance of the centrality of resistance for human liberation.
An attendee said the resistance front is capable of putting an end to the Israeli regime's relentless atrocities against Palestinians.
Israel has become now a fascist regime. Israel has become a barbaric and a racist and a totalitarian regime. That is the only country in the world which has been supported by Western hegemony and also NATO. But their time, it is nearer. And the resistance and the people of the world, through the international solidarity movement, they will find ways to dismantle the Israeli apartheid regime.
The delegations will be taking a tour to villages in southern Lebanon. They will also pay an official visit to Syria to show solidarity with Damascus in the face of U.S. sanctions.
Major transformations in recent years have caused more and more people to resonate with the values of resistance. Participants here consist of not only Lebanese and Palestinians, but people from around the world who are against the aggressive policies of Israel and the United States. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A successful first launch operation. Iran has test-fired its most advanced ballistic missile. The fourth-generation Khorramshahr-class long-range ballistic missile dubbed Khaybar is a liquid-fueled precision-guided missile that can carry a 1,500-kilogram warhead and accurately hit targets 2,000 kilometers farther.
Khorramshahr 4 is the developed version of previous models and is a stealth missile. It can easily bypass enemy air defenses due to its low radar cross-section. It is the result of years of hard work of our engineers at the Aerospace Industries Organization. With its impressive tactical capabilities, the Khorramshahr 4 missile shows that we are fully committed to defending our country.
Khorramshahr 4 has a unique guidance and control system which allows it to adjust its trajectory as it travels through outer space. The system is deactivated as it re-enters the atmosphere. This important feature makes Khorramshahr 4 missiles fully immune to any kind of electronic warfare counterattacks. The newly unveiled missile also has an incredibly short preparation and launch time, and thanks to its liquid-fueled engine, the missile can easily reach hypersonic speeds of Mach 16 in outer space and Mach 8 traveling through the Earth's atmosphere. This makes detecting and tracking the missile impossible, which means it is totally invisible to radars.
When we talk about our defense capabilities, the name Khorramshahr stands for self-reliance and sacrifice, the two qualities that lead to the liberation of the city of Khorramshahr back in 1982. So this type of missile is rightfully named Khorramshahr. And the fourth generation that was unveiled today marks a significant advancement in Iran's ballistic missile technology while enhancing its defense capabilities and deterrence. This is good news for our nation. All of this is happening on the 41st anniversary of the liberation of the southwestern city of Khorramshahr during the Iran-Iraq War, a major turning point that tipped the scales in Iran's favor, designating the word Khorramshahr as a code name for victory, perseverance, and self-reliance.
And what better way to celebrate the liberation anniversary of the city of Khorramshahr than by unveiling this ballistic missile? Khorramshahr 4 is a precision-guided missile which is considered a symbol of determination and self-sufficiency. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
After an intense year of deadly fighting between the Russian and Ukrainian armed forces, Bakhmut and nearby villages have reportedly been seized by Moscow, being an important roadway and industrial center with huge underground salt mines and with a pre-war population of 75,000. Bakhmut, also known as Artyomovsk in Russia, is located about 60 kilometers north of Donetsk, the regional capital of Donbas. The city has been so largely devastated that there are almost no intact buildings left in it. Over 3,500 residents of Bakhmut Artyomovsk have been evacuated and placed in a facility in the neighboring town of Shakhtyrs.
We left on May 20th, the day of liberation, because the city had been razed so thoroughly that living was impossible. Its destruction continues in this very moment. The level of danger is even higher than 1 to 2 months ago. This is our Stalingrad, but DPR acting head Pushilin has pledged that the city will be reconstructed and restored. We hope it will happen very soon.
Here at the Shakhtar's temporary accommodation center, there are people that fled the unprecedented bloody battles in Bakhmut in recent days. They survived bullets and strikes hitting their towns, but now they have to face a life in ruins. Most families from Bakhmut Artyomovsk left months ago as fighting in the city became vicious. But now, after several hundred of civilians, including children, have lost their lives, even those who vowed to stay to the end are living. According to Shakhtar's mayor, about 60 Bakhmut residents arrived in his town on Sunday, and as many will be transferred there shortly.
We spent 1 month hiding in the basement. It was horrible. While the Ukrainian soldiers were shelling our house, I was with my old mother. We never ever got out of our shelter. My mother was losing her mind. She saw things that were not there. One day she was even about to run out of the basement to put an end to her nightmare.
I've been a pensioner for 13 years, conducting a serene life, living with my mother. Our problems began 9 years ago, and we have to thank God if we are still alive today.
Russian forces now face the task of seizing the remaining part of the Donetsk region still under Ukrainian control, including several heavily fortified areas. Meanwhile, fighting around Donetsk is ongoing. Max Civili, Donetsk.
Oh.
On May 24th of the year 2000, Lebanese masses flocked to their hometowns and villages in a surprise move that shocked the Israeli army and sent the Israeli collaborators fleeing towards northern occupied Palestine. These towns witnessed over 18 years of Israeli occupation, terrorism, killing, and destruction. Thanks to the strategy of attrition adopted by the resistance movement, the Israeli army was left with no option but to withdraw unconditionally from the land it had occupied. Since then, Lebanon has celebrated May 25th as a national day of resistance and liberation.
We earned our freedom. It wasn't like they said, oh, we left. No, they didn't left. We make them leave.
Hassan was forced to leave his hometown during the Israeli occupation. He recalls how terrorized he was as a child when the Israelis first invaded South Lebanon.
I was forced to leave my land on 1982. And I was unable to come back until after 2000. It was a great moment. I can tell the difference, like when we used to drive or when we was kids. My parents used to say, don't look, don't smile, don't do nothing, don't breathe even. That's how much we were scared.
Today he brings his son to see the fruit of years of struggle.
After hard work and all the suffering that the army of Hezbollah went through, and fought hard and freed the South Lebanon, Junub. And now I can hear with my friends, five of them, all from Canada. They wanted to get a good vacation. We didn't know where to go. And I asked my dad, and he's like, Lebanon, you have to go to Lebanon. Now it's free, beautiful country.
Of course, it shows the strength, of course, of the community and how you can't take something that, you know, rightfully belongs to someone. And honestly, just overall, it's been beautiful so far here, and it just really shows how much love there is in the city.
After, you know, withdrawal in 2000, you can see the smile in the face of the people, especially the children. They can, and they can play, and they can walk around in peace, and they are really happy to go to come back to their homeland, which we really paid a lot of blood to get it back. And we are looking forward, really, for the Palestinians to live and to have the same feeling as we feel.
The fruit of liberation is seen by the people of Lebanon as a natural outcome of resistance, and they have voiced their support and encouragement to the Palestinian people that someday they too will be free. Maryam Saleh, Odaisi, South Lebanon.
Across France, top unions led another day of strikes aimed at winning the revocation of a recent 2-year hike to the retirement age. With President Emmanuel Macron refusing to budge, many are now demanding the movement expand into a complete general strike.
We must have a general strike to create a new system of society, as our current model allows the government and the bosses to totally ignore our needs. Everybody must get involved because everybody is affected.
Many speculate that Macron is so isolated from everyday French society that he may not understand how resentful the public mood is following one austerity measure after another since 2010.
Macron doesn't listen to us, but what's worse is that he looks down on us. He still doesn't care about all the protesting, so that's why our goal has to be to block the entire economy with a general strike. That will get his attention.
The general strike of 2019-2020 was the nation's longest labor action ever, but it ultimately failed. The strike shaved only 0.1% off of French economic growth that quarter, showing that a general strike's most powerful aspect may be its ability to shame and discredit those in power.
The biggest economic impact of striking is felt by the workers. The pre-COVID general strike failed because so many workers were just too impoverished to continue a strike that had lasted almost 2 months.
The government did all it could to stretch the general strike out, as their plan was to exhaust the strikers financially. They're using the same tactic now, and that's why we saw more than 4 months of massive protests before they even met with unions to discuss the age hike.
This spring has seen record strikes in other European nations, such as Belgium, Germany, Spain, and even the United Kingdom. Low salaries, record inflation, and perceptions that their governments refuse to democratically recognize the scope of the hardship are all consistently cited as reasons. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The right to go on strike, to withdraw one's labor over grievances with one's employer, potentially under threat in proposed legislation that gives the British government sweeping powers to clamp down on industrial action.
They say it's democratic when it's not democratic, so they're an affront to democracy, what they want on this bill. And it'll turn worker, they want to turn worker against worker, but it won't. It'll just cause confusion.
Mr. Speaker.
Formerly known as the Minimum Service Level Bill, voted on in Parliament Monday, the legislation enables the government to determine what a minimum level of service should be, with potential consequences for strikers and the unions that represent them.
Without the unions would face sequestration of their funds, which is obviously a serious, very serious step, and unions can't afford to go down that road. So it will effectively stop strike action in those parts of the economy, but it will also seek to scare people in other parts of the economy about what will happen to them should they take the decision to go on strike.
The freedom to form and join a union and to bargain collectively is one of the four international labour standards which the UK government has signed up to.
The UK is part of the ILO and signed up to all of its conventions. So the right to strike is really a fundamental human right. It's something that we should protect and be very aware of any legislation that seeks to restrict that. And I think, you know, I think internationally people will be concerned that here in the UK we're seeking to restrict that right.
Among the sectors impacted by the legislation, health, education, transport and fire services, all of which have staged several rounds of industrial action over pay and working conditions over the past year, in the face of the UK's cost of living crisis.
Strikes became common during the Industrial Revolution. The UK has recognized the right to strike since at least 1906. And the protesters and union leaders here say they're not going to allow that right to be eroded or taken away. Saeed Pereza, London.
Specialists at the Republican Hospital in Donetsk have warned that the number of civilians who have been hospitalized is dramatically on the rise as Ukrainian armed forces are using more advanced NATO-supplied weapons. Almost 1,000 wounded have been treated since the beginning of 2023, the trauma center in Donetsk has reported. Specialists believe that the latest weapons sent by NATO countries are more advanced and lethal.
Until not long ago, only civilians living near the front line got wounded or killed. Now, following the new medium and long-range weapons provided by NATO to Ukraine, we have a much higher number of civilians being hospitalized. Look behind my back. Our hospital was targeted a few weeks ago.
Ukrainian armed formations have shelled hospitals a number of times over the past months. This hospital in central Donetsk, Voroshilovsky district, was hit by the artillery on April 28. That shelling caused 9 civilian casualties and severe damage to the building. On that occasion, among the dead civilians was also a child. 16 people also suffered injuries from the blast. Kyiv's forces fired high-explosive fragmentation missiles produced in Slovakia and transferred to Ukraine by NATO countries.
We have been denouncing the situation since 2015. We started with the European Court of Human Rights, but for inexplicable reasons, our case was dismissed. We tried then with the International Criminal Court, but they have never visited the Donbass, and this case was subsequently dismissed. We are now trying to bring it forward to the UN. Will human rights be finally protected here as well?
In fear of attacks on residential areas, kids have been forced to switch to remote learning throughout the whole school year, which, by the way, ends on Tuesday. Max Civili, Donetsk.
in the limelight.
German conservatives are waging a crusade against the Muslim civil society. Last month, center-right and far-right parties in Germany proposed a motion to reinstate an expert group to surveil the country's Muslim population. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, it was one of the latest initiatives of the German conservatives in the midst of the election campaign in 2021, a crusade against organized Muslims in the name of fighting the specter of the so-called political Islamism. After losing the election and withdrawing from the government following a 16-year tenure, the Christian Democratic Union not only continues to support anti-Muslim policies, but has doubled down on this stance. In a position paper published in April 2021 and dedicated to fighting what has been dubbed political Islam, the party proposed to harden its stance towards surveilling, limiting, and potentially cracking down on Muslim civil society. Members on the party's European, national, and regional levels are promoting anti-Islam stances. The more recent trends are even more worrying. After a coalition between the Social Democrats, the Greens, and the Liberals formed a new government in December 2021, a pilot project of the Christian Democratic Parties, the Christian Democratic Union for Germany, CDU, and the Christian Social Union, CSU, the establishment of the expert group on political Islamism was not renewed. The group, launched by the Ministry of Interior, included proponents of anti-Muslim policies. The group's focus was initially to conduct research and analyze so-called political Islam, a notion that is not only very vague, but has also served to legitimize the targeting and repression of Muslim civil society in Germany. While some parliament members opted to bring an end to this group, it was not long before several of its members, such as Susan Schroeder and Crocide, alongside other anti-Muslim authors like Heiko Heinisch, protested loudly in the media to no avail. As a last resort, the center-right CDU/CSU, which had launched the expert group, initiated a debate in Germany's national parliament, the Bundestag. On March 16th, the CDU/CSU, along with the notorious anti-Muslim and far-right Alternative for Germany, AfD, proposed a motion for the reinstatement of the expert group. The AfD had come to power as a belated successful anti-Muslim political party following the footsteps of parties such as France's National Rally, previously known as National Front, and Austria's Freedom Party. In the past, the CDU and CSU had applauded the now former Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, who had implemented the Islam Act, which aimed at a stricter financial oversight of all religious Muslim organizations. Most importantly, when these politicians speak of Islamism, they do not mean a fringe group of Muslims, but the vast majority of religiously organized Muslims. The annual report of Germany's intelligence service, the Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution, has shown over the past two decades that a majority of Muslim organizations are included in this category, claiming that They present themselves outwardly as open, tolerant and open to dialogue, while anti-democratic and totalitarian tendencies continue to exist within the organizations. In addition, the German police forces in general have come under scrutiny after it was revealed that 17% of police personnel support openly racist statements, such as, they say, "The many Muslims sometimes make me feel like a stranger in my own country and I would have problems with Roma being in my area." This is not to speak of the structural challenges that such views of organized Muslims would present. In this vein, during the parliamentary deliberations, MP Christian Wirth, AFD, argued that 74% of all mosques belong to political groups, clearly showing that this campaign is aimed at a large segment of organized Muslims in Germany. Members of the governing coalition, such as Lamia Kador of the Greens, conducted the CDU-CSU saying that they want Muslims without Islam, and calling attention to their silence in March on the United Nations International Day against Islamophobia. Besides the call for reinstating the expert group and pushing for more financial control and surveillance, the AFD even called for funding and establishing chairs for research and teaching courses on political Islam at public universities and academic institutions. Such an invention would only further entrench and institutionalize the witch hunt against practicing Muslims. This is again one of the recommendations that were initially presented in the CDU-CSU's position paper back in 2021. While the current German federal government is not following in the footsteps of the CDU-CSU's policies targeting Muslims, parties on the right are closing ranks. In regard to anti-Muslim policies, there is an increasing proximity of the center-right, CDU, CSU, and the far-right, FAD. Meanwhile, Anadolu Agency reported that Germany's Muslim community have called for a more determined stance against Islamophobia, saying Muslims continue to experience prejudice, hate crimes, and discrimination in their daily lives. The anniversary of Church Christ Mosque attacks painfully reminds us that the stirring up prejudices and hatred against Muslims do not stop at words, but they can be carried out into action, the president of the Central Council of Muslims in Germany said in a statement. Ayman Maziak said, "This also makes it clear that we have to take much more determined stand against Islamophobia in our society, even if it's sometimes hypocritically portrayed as the criticism of Islam." On March 15, 2019, an Australian white supremacist shot dead 51 Muslim worshippers and wounded 40 others at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. Last year, the UN designated March 15th as the International Day to Combat Islamophobia. Maziak called on the German government to take concrete steps to address the problem and reiterated the Muslim community's demand to appoint a commissioner to combat Islamophobia. Germany has witnessed growing racism and Islamophobia in recent years, fueled by the propaganda of far-right groups and parties, which have exploited the refugee crisis and attempts to stoke fear of immigrants. Authorities registered at least 272 Islamophobic crimes in 2022, including verbal and physical assaults, threatening letters, and arson attacks targeting mosques. A country of over 84 million people, Germany has the second largest Muslim population in Western Europe after France. It is home to nearly 5 million Muslims, according to official figures.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Russia has summoned ambassadors of Germany, Sweden, and Denmark to protest what it calls deliberate delays and lack of progress in investigations into the Nord Stream pipeline blast. Moscow accuses Western countries of trying to conceal the traces and the true perpetrators of the crime. This is while NATO is pushing to draw more European and non-European countries under its influence zone to put pressure on Russia. Ukraine is also continually being flooded with Western weapons and military equipment. In their latest move, some NATO countries have agreed to train Ukrainian pilots to operate U.S.-made F-16 fighter jets. Is there any hope for an end to the war in Ukraine in the near future? And will the West ever stop its pressure campaigns against other nations? We'll be discussing those issues and more on tonight's Spotlight program with our guests. Chair of UN Affairs of Ukrainian World Congress, Andrei Dobryansky, is joining us from New York. And we also have podcaster and journalist Esha Krishnaswamy joining us from St. Petersburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program, to both of you. Let's start off with Mr. Dobryansky in New York. Sir, Russia has summoned the ambassadors of Germany, Sweden, and Denmark in protest over what it called, quote, the complete lack of results in an investigation to identify who blew up the Nord Stream gas pipelines last year. Why do you think this investigation has taken this long?
I believe that the investigation is ongoing. We know that at this point we haven't had criminal charges against a civilian airliner that was shot down in the summer of 2014. Nor are there many other criminal cases that those ambassadors can bring up with the Russian state, given all the poisonings that have happened all over Europe. And to this day, no criminal charges have been levied against the Russian state. So here you're mentioning a physical object. Many civil rights leaders across the world have pointed out to the fact that so long as there's a righteous struggle going on, material objects should not be given precedence over human lives. And again, I refer back to the 298 innocent lives, many of them from Denmark, Germany, etc., who were killed by Russians.
Esha Krishnaswamy, Russia's foreign ministry expressed frustration of EU countries stalling the Nord Stream blast inquiry. Does Russia at this point believe these European countries have something to hide? Also, if you would like to respond to what our guest in New York said, please do so.
Absolutely. So the Nord Stream pipeline carries gas into Germany and other European countries. And this actually has an actual impact on civilian lives. If they don't have gas, they cannot do things like heat their homes and et cetera. As for your question, of course, the European countries are hiding something. And it is obvious because there's only one group that has an incentive to sabotage the Nord Stream pipeline. Russia built it, and they can literally hit the off button anytime they want to. So, of course, we also know about Mr. Seymour Hersh's wonderful report that came out a few weeks ago, where he says that it was definitely an act of sabotage by people involved with the U.S. intelligence agency. And, of course, we know that many European countries don't conduct an independent foreign policy from the U.S., and therefore they are walking in tandem. So I think the Russian foreign minister is absolutely right in that these European countries are stalling the investigation.
Mr. Dobryansky, Russia's Dmitry Medvedev, he's warned of launching a preemptive nuclear strike if the West would go on to provide Ukraine with nukes. Is the threat of this war morphing into something bigger and broader just increasing as each day goes by? We already know that Russia and Belarus have signed documents allowing for the placement of Russian tactical nuclear weapons on the territory of Belarus.
Yes, that's a breaking of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty that Belarus swore to the rest of the world never to have nuclear weapons on its territory ever again. So that's something that the international community will have to decide what kind of repercussions and sanctions will have to go upon Belarus for going back on its promise, thumbing its nose at international peace agreements. As far as the Russian state and what they promise, they have been warning the world that they will launch nuclear weapons for over a decade. This is a constant refrain from them. They should not be the ones listened to, as they are the ones who have been credibly acknowledged as having had committed war crimes in multiple territories. So it's for the rest of the world to keep on doing what they're doing. The International Criminal Court already has cases brought up before it, and the world is moving swiftly towards a tribunal for the breaking of the peace as well.
Ms. Krishnaswamy, would you like to respond to Mr. Dobryansky in New York?
There is a lot to say. So first of all, the Belarus's promise for a not to have nuclear agreement on its soil was done by the previous leader, Shukeyevich, who was not elected ever, and he was quickly removed from office, and so he has never been selected. That's the first thing. The second thing is that circumstances have changed. And with NATO's aggression, and yet just yesterday I watched this video from 2015 from Mr. Friedman, who talked about how the U.S. Controls the entire sea and their entire point is to surround Russia and having hostile countries around Russia. And they've already, which is a threat, existential threat to Russia's national security. So that's the first thing. As for nuclear weapons, we know that there's only one country that has ever used it in a war, and that is the USA. And another thing is that what we notice is that when other countries don't have nuclear weapons, bad things happen, like what happened in Iraq or Libya. So many countries will have an incentive to develop nuclear weapons as a defensive mechanism. But the irresponsible thing is that the United Kingdom is providing Ukraine with depleted uranium, and Ukraine is saying that they want to hit Russian targets with this. So, of course, with this kind of provocation. I understand where Mr. Medvedev comes from. I may not agree with him, but I understand the need for an aggressive posturing.
Mr. Dobryansky, I have a sense that you will be disagreeing on a lot of issues with our guest in St. Petersburg. Would you like to respond to what Ms. Krishnaswamy has just mentioned?
No, I'm just firmly against the proliferation of nuclear weapons. So whatever people find a need to break international agreements, whether it's the Belarusians, whether it's people who support Russia redeploying nuclear weapons, I think the entire international community is on the same page here. We would rather not see proliferation of nuclear weapons, and it is not a good thing. It's not a smart strategy for other nations to acquire nuclear technology.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. Dobryansky, a senior ally of the President Vladimir Putin, namely Dmitry Medvedev. He said that the conflict in Ukraine could actually last for decades. Now, if that turns out to be the case, what is the cost of this conflict and its repercussions for Europe as opposed to the United States?
Well, Russia has deployed its forces onto foreign territory for decades already. We know that Russia has its forces in Moldova against the wishes of the Moldovan government. It has its forces in Georgia. It has its forces in Nagorno-Karabakh. It also occupies territory that it claims it took from Japan after World War II. There are many parts of the world where Russia utilizes its forces, not least of which the horrors that are being inflicted in Mali by its private security forces. So I think it's upon the rest of the world to finally address this. And this is what we're seeing. We're seeing in an international community, not just those who stand with Ukraine in terms of making sure that Ukraine can get the support and armaments that it needs, but we're seeing that the entire international body has voted repeatedly. The last time, over 140 nations voted in unison to condemn what has happened in Ukraine. And that's the only way forward in this. It's, again, in contrast to other opinions, I'm against the proliferation of nuclear weapons. I'm against the imperialism of a country invading other countries. And I think the rest of the world stands lockstep with this viewpoint.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Ms. Krishnaswamy, if you'd like to respond to that also, here's another issue that I want you to break down for us. Washington has said that Kiev should not use U.S. arms inside Russia following accusations that pro-Ukraine militia used American armored vehicles in an attack in the Russian border region of Belgorod. Chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, claimed restrictions on U.S. support to Ukraine, quote, saying that this is a Ukrainian war, it's not a war between the United States and Russia, and it's not a war between NATO and Russia. I think many would disagree with those comments at this point.
Yes. So let me first address what you said, and then I'll address what the guest previously said. So obviously, it is not, there are no U.S. boots, as far as we know, there are no U.S. boots on the ground. So, of course, it is not a direct conflict. But the U.S. has overthrown the democratically elected government in Ukraine in 2014 after the Maidan events, installed a U.S.-friendly government who basically deregulated, accepted IMF terms and conditions that basically lowered wages, took out price controls, increased gas prices by 40%, and all of this was done by an unelected interim government. So to claim that Ukraine is sovereign and is a joke, of course, Ukraine is doing everything that the U.S. government wants it to do. But as for not using U.S. weapons, once you give somebody weapons, it is pretty hard to restrict how they use it. So it seems like it's like an empty gesture on the part of U.S. when they've been arming and training the people in Ukraine since 2014, so for nearly 9 years. As for our guest's comment about alleged Russian aggression, he just throws around the word imperialism. It's not when a big country does something. It is when you go to a country and basically you deregulate their markets and then you flood them with goods and bankrupt their local businesses. So there is a very specific definition of imperialism that does not fit Russia, because what Russia does is mostly export raw material and they import manufactured goods, which is the complete opposite of what the UK did when it came to India, or the US does anywhere around the world. You just have to check the trade balances in the IMF. As for Russian aggression, that is just interpretation. But what I do have to say is, what international community? Usually when people say international community, they usually just mean European countries and the U.S. And the U.S. has been known to throw its weight around. For example, U.S. and NATO. For example, last year, Bangladesh decided to abstain from a resolution condemning Russia, and the next day, the country of Lithuania canceled vaccine shipments to Bangladesh. So these are vaccines that are coming from the poorest, for the poorest people in the world. So many countries are held hostage in this grand scheme of international chess. So we have to be very careful what we mean by international community.
Mr. Dorbianski, would you like to respond to that?
Just that it's always best to get information directly and factually, not read anonymous things online. What Lithuania did, it's belied by the facts. But that's going in line with trying to maintain. Sorry, is that me?
Excuse me, but I'm sorry, but this was literally Lithuanian foreign minister announced it, and that they canceled shipments to Bangladesh on March 3rd of 2022. So I appreciate you not discrediting me when I've actually done my research.
I don't need to discredit you. You've broken international law by crossing into a combat zone. We know that. What is important, though, is to make sure that we get the facts accurate. And part of the long-term imperial campaign against Russia's neighbors has been the discrediting of these historically oppressed peoples and their national stories. What has been repeated today is a long discredited, but more and more repeated over the last year, storyline that for some reason Ukraine wasn't able to have a self-determination when it shook off the shackles of imperialism in 2014. This was all done in accordance with international law, as we had international observers. I was there for every election in 2014 and again in 2019 for the national elections, the interim parliamentary elections in between as well. Just like to state for the record that when Ukraine does go forward, it's usually in line with the majority of the General Assembly, not going against international bodies like Russia does when it breaks the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Ms. Krishnaswamy, what about NATO moving towards absorbing more countries into the U.S.-led bloc? Russia says NATO expansion toward neutral states undermines prospects for security dialogue in Europe. Is NATO expanding towards Russia's borders at this time the safest move, in your opinion?
Absolutely not. I mean, it has already expanded since 1989. It has included many, many countries in the Warsaw Pact, like Poland, the Czech Republic, and now it has also included the Baltics, like Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia. So, and NATO is a treaty where basically it is kind of an international. So it's a solidarity treaty, as in if one member is aggrieved, all the other members have to join in. And that is a great recipe to start to enlarge a conflict. But like I said, as we've read from the RAND Corporation policy in 2019 and so on, this has always been the plan to contain Russia. And then in the future, the U.S. has plans to contain China, because once again, they feel very threatened. And once again, I'd like to reiterate that a lot of these international bodies and international rules were agreed upon in 1944, when major countries like India and China did not exist. So it is basically the rules are rigged for basically what the U.S. and Britain want. So we have to kind of remember the history of how a lot of these international bodies are used. And how exactly is President Yanukovych, a democratically elected president of Ukraine, imperialism? That is a very puzzling question since he is Ukrainian, but that's another story. But that's about it.
All right, one last question for both of you, if you may be brief so we get both sides of the argument. And Mr. Dobryansky, let's rewind to a past statement by U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, who said, one of Washington's goals in Ukraine is to see a, quote-unquote, weakened Russia. Why does Washington want a weakened Russia?
I believe that statement was that Russia, that the rest of the world and Washington in the lead would not like to see Russia repeat what they've done here. So obviously they would like Russia to not have the ability to once again invade a neighboring country or threaten any other country. Again, I go back to my beginning statement. We are already 9 years after the killing of 298 innocent civilians by Russian forces targeting an innocent airliner. Numerous people targeted and poisoned throughout Europe. These are all allies of the United States. These are business partners with Russia. And it seems to act with impunity when it comes to those kind of events. And finally, the time has come to address these kind of injustices. So obviously, the rest of the world would love to see Russia not be able to continue to act with impunity. And that includes, deploying nuclear tactical nuclear weapons in a country that has forsworn tactical nuclear weapons. This is once again thumbing its nose at the entire international convention. Almost every multilateral, bilateral treaty that Russia has signed has been ripped up going forward. And so the rest of the world needs to know how to deal with a malicious force this way. I think it's moving closer and closer to for the rest of the world to recognize it, as many countries already have, as a state sponsor of terror.
Ms. Krishnaswamy, same question to you. How do you read into Lloyd Austin's comments that one of Washington's goals in Ukraine is to see a weakened Russia?
I mean, it is obvious because, like I said last week, Russia doesn't roll over for U.S. foreign policy. So the U.S. often sees Russia as a threat. And for example, one of the major blockades is that U.S. had plans for balkanizing Syria. And when Russia came in, it has protected the Syrian government and the existing Syrian government from a lot of the nefarious forces like al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, et cetera, that the NATO and the U.S. has armed. On top of this, we need to be really careful about what the international